Do I use the gavel?
Yes.
Very good.
Two hits.
So it looks like we have a...
You do want to start off.
Yes, I know.
Sure if you guys have met or not, so I can first name it.
I will. I appreciate that.
Good afternoon. I think we will call the meeting to order. And hope everybody is having a good day so far. And following the agenda, it looks like the first item is oath of office. So that will be maybe sworn in. Okay. I, Leonard Freehoff.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
That I will support, protect, and defend.
The Constitution and government.
Constitution and government.
Of the United States.
Of the United States.
And the Constitution and government.
And the Constitution and government.
Of the state of Nevada.
Of the state of Nevada.
Against all enemies.
Against all enemies.
Whether domestic or foreign.
Whether domestic or foreign.
And that I will bear true faith.
And that I will bear true faith.
Allegiance and loyalty to the same.
Allegiance and loyalty to the same.
Any ordinance.
Any ordinance.
Resolution or any law.
Resolution or any law.
Of any state notwithstanding.
Of any state notwithstanding.
And that I will well and faithfully perform.
And I will well and faithfully perform. All the duties of a member.
Of the Southern Nevada Health District Facilities Advisory Board.
Of the Southern Nevada Health District Facilities Advisory Board. On which I'm about to enter. So help me God.
Can you please note for the record that you actually did not call the meeting to order because we don't have quorum?
Okay, thank you. I was uncertain. I know that we were close.
Very hard to hear.
Have we started? I can't tell.
Can you do a roll call?
Yes, we can do a roll call, please. We're checking to see if we have a quorum, so we're going to take a roll call.
Okay. I'll go ahead and start. Do we have anyone from Bolger City Hospital on the line? Anyone from Dignity Health?
Yes.
Two. Anyone from HCA on the line?
Alexis is here with Southern Health.
Perfect.
And Jeremy with Mountain View.
Perfect. Anyone from Mike O'Callaghan Federal Hospital?
Colonel Flowers on the line.
Perfect. Anyone from Mount Vista Hospital?
Vince Villial on the line.
Perfect. Anyone from North Vista?
There was North Vista Hospital. I'm sorry.
Okay.
This is Vince Villial, North Vista.
Okay. Ross and Neal?
Present.
Anyone from Valley Health System?
This is Rob at Summerlin.
Mm-hmm.
This is Sam at Desert Springs and Henderson Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Sajid Centennial.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone from UMC, of course?
Present, Mason.
Anyone from VA? And anyone from Westcare? We have quorum.
Okay, we do have a quorum, so we will now officially call the meeting to order. Item Roman numeral number 3, public comment. This is the opportunity for anybody to come forward for public comment.
Sorry, Leonard. We need to note for the record that the meeting wasn't accurately publicly posted. So that's...
Essentially, we can you can have this as an informational meeting, but not
meeting.
Vote on any items on the agenda.
Okay, did posting. Everybody hear that on the phone? Apparently, there was an issue with posting of the meeting, so this meeting will be for informational only, and we will not be voting on any items. So it looks like the adoption of the 2014 agenda will be for information. We won't be able to approve the minutes for the meeting, so we will move on to report, discussion, and action. I believe we are going to go out of order to accommodate Dr. Lugwin. I believe he's got another time commitment, so if you're ready, we'll go ahead and let you present.
Sure. Thank you. Good afternoon. Again, for the record, my name is Fermin Leguen. I struggled with my name since I was in primary school, so that's not an issue. I just want to briefly talk to you about our recent effort with the Federal Qualified Health Center. As you might know, we received a HRSA grant last September. It was $650,000 that allowed us to start what is called a new access point for FQHC, or Federal Qualified Health Center. We are now working towards preparation to what is called operational site visit from HRSA. That will be in February 25th to 27th, and that is kind of the what they call the 120 days operational visit to where HRSA makes the decision whether we are properly functional or not in terms of SQAC. Our health center right now is providing several services. We are providing primary care. Actually, we started offering primary care here about a year ago in November 2018. Our primary care operation right now is very limited. We offer adult and pediatric care with in a very limited space in regarding the number of rooms that we have available right now. Also part of the SQAC is our sexual health clinic, and as well as our family planning clinic, and also we offer refugee health services through our Fair Qualified Health Center. And also the pharmacy is part of those services as well. Among the new things that we are trying to implement it in the Federal Qualified Health Center is the implementation of dental services. Last year we started offering very basic preventive dental services here through a dental hygienist. Our intention is to, in the long term, to partner with UNLV Dental School and have here at least four dental chairs so we can have that partnership with the school and be able to offer that service to our patients here. Our second goal is also to start the implementation of behavioral health services here. We are actively recruiting for behavioral health providers so we can start that program. And then, of course, be able to offer that service, including medication-assisted therapy and other behavioral health activities that we want to offer here. Also, as part of our efforts, we want to expand our capabilities in terms of structure. So we are in discussion with our board and trying to identify funding to actually expand our clinic space at this facility so we can offer all those services. And our current budget is $650,000 that we received from HRSA, in addition to about $7 million that we have already in place from the other programs that we incorporated into the FQHC. And I think I will stop here. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Lugwin?
I have one question. How many providers do you have in your primary care clinic?
Well, in our primary care clinic, we have right now two providers. We have a family a practice a provider working with a nurse practitioner. We also have multiple providers in the other clinics, but those are more specialized services like sexual health, Ryan White, HIV, or family planning. Again, our intention is to be able to gain more space in his facility so we can bring more providers and then expand that service to the community.
And then also one other question, Doctor. Do you have a Medicaid eligibility specialist that will help qualify patients that may be eligible for any programs?
Right, absolutely, yes. We have eligibility workers here to help us with our patients. And also we have, I believe, like 3 days a week, we have a staff from Medicaid who come here and assist patients with eligibility.
Wonderful, yes. Thank you. Yeah.
And I just had a question about your days and hours of operation.
Our services are from 8 to 4:30. We are expanding actually from up to 6 p.m. 3 days a week. And I believe we are starting to do that February 1st, if I'm not wrong. In the long term, we plan to actually offer 5 days a week, 8 to 6 p.m.
So just one more question, Dr. Le Guin. Where are your current locations?
This building here, 280 South Decatur, is our main facility for the QAC. We also have another facility that is not part of the QAC currently at East Las Vegas. It's, I believe it's 500 Nellis Avenue. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
How will you receive referrals? Do you have brochures or can we refer patients on an outpatient basis?
Well, yes, you can refer patients in outpatient. I mean, to do your discharge planning or outpatient services. We, as I said, we are right now developing all those resources for the QAC, and we're trying to partner with our local hospitals and other QAC in the area as well. To expand those services and so people know about what we're doing, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And I just have another question about kind of capacity. I know you mentioned that you have some limited space and providers, but obviously looking to grow over time. So I'm assuming you're still accepting new patients, or do you have any caps or limitations on new patients?
No, we are accepting new patients. Okay. Yes, we are. Thank you.
Okay, good. Very good. Any other questions for either those here or on the phone? Is there any action required? Sounds like it was more for information. Okay, well, we appreciate the information. Thank you very much, and we certainly wish you all the best. Sounds like a good resource to have for the community.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity, and I just have to say that I'm amazing that this meeting is happening because I used to work in Miami, Florida before, and we always have a really hard time getting the hospitals together for any activity. So basically, it would only happen when there was, you know, some issue with preparedness or, you know, bioterrorism, those kind of acute kind of activities. So I really have to say that you are doing a great job, because it's very hard to get people like you in a room together. Thank you.
Good job. Hey,
good work. All right, very good. Thanks again. We'll move back to item number one on the agenda. Deputy Chief Jeff Buchanan is going to talk to us about a 1 October patient tracking software.
think we're good now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members. For the record, my name is Jeff Buchanan. I'm the Deputy Fire Chief at Cloud County Fire, and I'm here with Arlene Chapman. Together, we are two of the emergency management team of Clark County, and we are here on behalf of Deputy Chief, soon-to-be Fire Chief, John Steinbeck. And we were going to take this opportunity to apprise you all of EMTRAC. And before we do that, I just wanted to kind of give some context to why we are here. Everybody in this room is well aware of the tragedy that hit Southern Nevada in Route 91. It was an awesome spectacle as far as pulling together resources and coming together as a region and really handling a very, very intense situation. But during that intense situation, what it did highlight was some really shortcomings from us out in the field and a struggle that's been ongoing for a number of years, and that was patient tracking. Speaking from my own personal experience at that particular event on the PIO side of things, deconflicting and coming up with consistent information of who and where the injured were and fatalities was a very, very, very difficult task. And frankly, there was a lot of conflict in information. And so when those pieces of information were being distributed out to the public, there were errors, and it produced a number of issues, not only for family members but for policymakers. So where we are as a region is we highlighted that as an issue, and we knew that was something that urgently needed some resolution. So we have come upon a tracking system that can assist in taking patients from a man-made or natural disaster and through the course of the medical process to hospitals. And where we think that this will solve issues is, one, it will help families locate their loved ones through the Family Assistance Center. We could set things up with the 211 phone system, and we would be able to supply from the EMTRAC, we would be able to supply an avenue where people could get some answers to important questions like where their loved ones might be. And number two, from the hospital perspective, and that's why we're here, is hopefully you would also see this as a tremendous resource so the limited amount of personnel that you all have in your organizations could be freed up to do their medical interventions and wouldn't be duplicitous and redundant in so many areas where people are calling in to get information, pulling the people inside of your hospitals away from their vital interventions that they're providing to patients. So I wanted to give that a little bit in brief overview on the EMTRAC system and why we're here, and you're already, your organizations are already very much behind what we're doing, but we wanted to give you a little bit more of an overview. And Arlene, who's been the tip of the spear for really this region in EMTRAC and doing a phenomenal job, she's going to be able to give you some more intricate detail, walk you through a little bit of what EMTRAC is, answer some technical questions. And overall, we just wanted to be here to give you a better preview of what we think is an excellent product. We're not saying it's the panacea, it's not the end-all be-all, but right now it's a consistent way for all of us to approach what we think is a common struggle.
Great. Thank you, Chief. That is on. Okay. Again, Arlene Chapman from the Office of Emergency Management, the Clark County Fire Department. The goal really is, you know, to offer a centralized way to track the data, and as the chief said, you know, we can only improve upon how we can help someone find their loved one in a crisis when we have so many casualties, and we know that you know, just the bulk of calls and work that you had to do to have that information available to the public. We're hoping that this is going to help, you know, everyone have a better way to do that going forward. So the EMTRAC project is a grant-funded project, and in partnership with the Health District Emergency Preparedness and the Office of Emergency Management, the urban area through Homeland Security funding as well, we've been able to put together a project to roll out the software and put it in front of our stakeholders and see if this is something that, you know, helps solve this issue and helps us get farther down the road on that. And, you know, we've also been able to, in doing that, we've hired a contractor because we realize that to do this statewide is a huge lift, and we need some help in getting the rollout done and out through the region. So, again, I was just going to show you really briefly the software without getting into the typical, I mean, all the details of it. Again, our goal was just to offer a centralized place and a HIPAA-compliant platform to start with going forward. So let me log in here real quick. Doing pretty good for not being left-handed. Wouldn't that be embarrassing if that didn't work? So how EMTrack works, just as a quick overview, is out in the field, the preferred way is that by a smart device, or it could be a laptop, and we've tried on Toughbooks and iPads and phones. You know, not every agency and every situation is going to be different, but the idea is that out in the field, that data could be collected quite quickly. There's very few fields that are required. A lot more data could be put in, but the data is put in very quickly, either from a wristband or any unique identifier. You know, and it could be done in any part of the process, right? Whether it's, you know, triage, transport, at the hospital, any of those places could be an input point for the data. And once that data is put in the field, it is one way. You cannot bring that back, you know, look at pictures or anything, and that's part of how it maintains its HIPAA compliance. Okay, so what we're looking at here is actually what we call the dashboard, and this would be one of the views that, say, a regional administrator or an operational administrator would look at to see the data from a centralized view. Okay, so this is say in an operations center or in with medical surge, right? That this would be a view that say an administrator would see. Okay, so again, the data coming in from the field. And again, this is obviously completely configurable how this looks. But what's nice is, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You look at this and you can get a pretty quick idea of the different triage categories. Once an event is going on, you can also see where the number of patients are. Okay, and then you can drill down in most of these areas to pull up the detail. And again, that would be, say, regional administrator might be able to see all the detail, right? Other folks might just see an aggregate number, and that's how it maintains the HIPAA for the most part. Let me open one of these real quick. Right, for example, and this is practice data from one of our training sessions. Okay, so you can see how really quickly you can drill down and get the information that's in there so far. And it tells you where they are and the status. You can also, at this point, change it, transport or received, say, into a medical facility. Okay. So again, this just gives you the centralized view, and generally we would have calls would come into, say, the operations center, the multi-agency coordination center, as a resource request to get the numbers. And again, you know, you're still going to have to do some deconflicting, you know, depending on if you have somebody entered in twice or something. They're still going to have to do deconflicting, but this is going to give you a pretty good idea of how many casualties you have. And it also gives, you know, medical surge the ability to put together the numbers much more easily. So I won't go too much further into that, but I'm happy to take questions on that. And again, we are basically right in the middle of the training rollout for EMTrack. You know, we're starting with emergency medical, first responders, and then hospitals. So most of your agencies are starting to be contacted and getting to your training folks, training the trainer, and getting the product out in front of the stakeholders at this point. I'd be happy to take any.
If I could just add a little bit, Arlene, that, thank you for that portion of the presentation, that we have a couple things. One, we want to focus on, this is a one-stop shop data clearinghouse, which is something that we don't have right now in the system. Two, which to the fiscal responsibilities that you all share, this is something that's completely grant funded, so there isn't a financial impact to your organizations. And three, that this has already been stress test twice, not at the gravity and magnitude of the entire system, but we've had one large scale exercise in Silver Crucible, which a couple of the hospitals participated in, and then of course New Year's Eve, which is the real deal, and we also stress tested it there. I'm not here to report to you that there are no bugs in the system that work flawlessly. That would be disingenuous, but we do see promise. We do think that it's working, and we do think that it is going to provide us a solution to what we think, again, is a pretty common struggle. So with that, we'd be happy to take any more questions that you might have.
Is this program used daily, or is it an event that triggers the use? Because I always worry about maintaining competency when something's only used once a year, or once every 6 months, or during drills, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then if it is an event-based, what is the trigger? Like 5 patients, 10 patients, 10-car pileup, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay. Well, as far as, I mean, MCI, did you want to answer?
Well, I'll answer a portion. I think some of it is we're working through that exact trigger, whether it be 5 patients, 10 patients, okay? So I think that one is kind of to be determined. As for our plan as a value is to use it on large-scale incidents. But I can tell you that across the country, and I can't remember if what was the jurisdiction that was using it every day?
Michigan.
Yeah, St. Louis. Okay, so we know of at least one, if not a couple, of organizations, areas, jurisdictions that are using it every day, perhaps for the reason that you mentioned, to increase competency. But for us, because this is such a large issue and one that involves hospital, pre-hospital, emergency services, you know, fire, the health district, we want to make sure everybody's on the same page. So could that be an evolution for us? Maybe. But I think right now what we're all focused on is the large scale events, the MCIs, both man-made and natural.
Right, absolutely.
Just a couple of feedback. So I had an opportunity to look at this with Chief Steinbeck, and really the light bulb went off immediately on lessons learned, and thank you for addressing the lessons learned from that event on October 1st, because I personally witnessed the inefficiencies in the information and trying to gather where certain individuals were, because a lot of people just didn't have their ID on them or dropped their phones and their purses. And so there was a lot of, I know personally calling several people on this committee trying to locate family members. So there is a lot of value to this, especially as you open up your incident command and we're taking in intake logs and documenting, to have a single repository that pulls it all together, not only for your hospital, but also for incident command for the county and the state and others. So, because I did see the inefficiency. I would see people in our incident command and they're back and forth, right? They're running back to Metro and trying to just reconcile all the names. And so this is great, but also Kim, I had back to your competency and frequency of use. Chiefs, on our end, we get our own logins, and one of my questions to Chief Steinbeck was, can we use this for our own internal drilling and create our own little exercises within the hospital to be able to, and obviously that's a joint commission showing that we're right. Drilling our incident command, emergency management. So the tool seems really good, but also provides information to the incident command for the county. So when we're looking for patients, there's one phone call, because I know at the first day we had like 5,000 phone calls coming in trying to locate patients, and we had to create multiple different phone numbers. So the nice thing is this could potentially go to one source and we can track where somebody is in a mass scale event.
No, absolutely.
Okay.
That's a quick question. Has there been any thought to use this kind of in advance in those scheduled mass casualty events, potentially like, you know, Life is Beautiful, EDC, things where you're selling tickets and you have a known mass of people, to getting them pre-registered into the system? Or is it only after something develops, entering in 300 patients into the system, how good you are would be difficult. So any thoughts of doing it in advance?
Yeah, and actually, I appreciate you bringing that up. We've been trying to use it at our larger special events. We've used it at EDC, I want to say twice, right? Life is Beautiful, and any of the larger special events that we have coming up. I mean, it's a good way to practice, and then obviously, if that were to develop into an incident or anything, we would already be prepared to do that. So, yeah, it's a great opportunity to use the system. Absolutely.
A follow-up question in terms of getting user logins for the system so we can start looking at who, do you recommend just like a few key people at each facility? Would you recommend everyone at each facility? Like how would you best think to deploy this to the different facilities in town?
Yeah. Our initial plan was to have the agencies provide us with names of who'd you like your organizational administrators to be, right? Who are the people that you would like to manage your partition, we're calling it. So, you know, to set up accounts, you'll be able to do that on your own, possibly start incidents, you know, and manage the data. So that's how we've rolled it out so far as organizational administrators, and then we can have train the trainers so that you can do a lot of that work internally, and then actually an end user training as well. That's kind of the structure that initially we put together, and as we go out to the different agencies, we're finding out, you know, what works best for you. You know, because we don't know who's the best person to do this in your agency. It may vary. So, but that's our initial structure. Yeah.
And for like password resets and all that, wouldn't be calling Health District, it'd be calling your local administrator, basically.
That's the idea. Yes.
Okay,
right. Right.
Spent most of your presentation updating my password, which is fine. And it works. It's awesome. But yeah, I think that. So I would just suggest, I mean, looking into it, like the y'all see the user list on the EM resource, right? EM resource. Other
exactly
resource we have, and we have the different, that might be a starting place for those of you that have people logged into that site, as you make sure they have access to the system.
Right.
Well, certainly very useful information, and I think we've heard that's going to be a value-added tool for us. Hopefully we won't have to utilize it too often, but it sounds like there could be a lot of different applications. I do have a question about your timing from a rollout perspective. Is there a goal in terms of when to have the training completed and have it up and running and being ready for use by all parties?
Well, as we can actually use it, I mean, on a pilot basis now. And the rollout for the training, again, we're kind of getting in the thick of it right now. And the goal is that we're going to progress through an exercise series with drills, tabletop exercises, functional drills, and a full scale. I believe this full scale, we're looking at trying to do that before it gets too hot for summer, so about the end of May, having a full scale. So that's our timeline, at least for this grant project. You know, and then going forward, you know, we'll see the appetite as far as expanding that more region-wide. But the grant project, that's kind of what we're looking at the moment.
Okay.
That makes sense.
And so based on that comment, I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a bit of a work in progress, so to speak. So once it's implemented, there are a variety of options that I heard people discuss here. Do you think it would be prudent, or is there an appetite to have them come back and present once it's rolled out and being utilized for tabletop drills or things of that nature? We can maybe learn what's working well in the field and, you know, opportunities to probably have some more consistency for the utilization. So do you think there might be an opportunity to come back and have some discussion in that regard from a follow-up perspective?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We'll come back after that large-scale exercise and give you a summary, a debrief, lessons learned. Mm-hmm. We'd be happy to do that.
Okay. Absolutely.
Everybody agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you so much for presenting. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, we will move on to item number 3 on the agenda. Dr. Johnson, you're going to talk to us about flu and vaping update.
Yes. Yeah, a couple of quick updates for you. as I mentioned before, I've provided updates on the lung injury epidemic that's happening nationally, and every other Thursday now we have update calls with the CDC and the FDA on what cases look like nationally and as well as locally. And as of January 7th, there's been 2,602 hospitalized cases from all 50 states. This is up about 41 cases from December. It's, so the frequency of these is decreasing a little bit, but we're still seeing cases roll in from virtually every state. There's also been a total of 57 deaths in 27 states. And the primary culprit in a lot of this is vitamin E acetate, which is a thickening agent that's used in primarily in the THC liquid that's vaped. It's been found in lung samples from all the cases that have either come down with a lung injury or have are deceased. So, but there are other chemical compounds that CDC and FDA are looking at, like propylene glycol and other chemical compounds, not only in the THC liquid that's being vaped, but also in the nicotine liquid. So there have been cases where the majority of the cases have been individuals who have vaped THC with vitamin E acetate as a thickening agent and have obtained it primarily from informal sources. So it could be a friend online, the black market. Most of the nicotine exclusively that's been vaped has been obtained from retailers. So the recommendation still stands from the health district as well as the CDC that we caution people to vape at all if they're going to use this, because we still haven't completely put our finger on exactly what's causing it. But I guess if there's any good news in this, the frequency of cases seems to be slowing a bit, as do the deaths. On last Thursday's call, we've submitted a lot of product samples, as other state and local health jurisdictions have, to the CDC and FDA, a lot of the vaping, you know, the liquids and so on, and they're doing aerosol analysis and all kinds of things. I think it's mid-February when we'll get results back on some of the products that we submitted locally, so could provide another update at the next meeting or something on kind of the debrief from CDC and FDA on this. Our cases locally, we've had 6 cases to date, fortunately no deaths, and that hasn't changed. That hasn't changed really since the last report. I will say that there's, in case you hear a buzz about this, we have, there was a settlement out of the Attorney General's office with Johnson & Johnson on a completely unrelated issue to vaping, but there was money generated from the settlement, and all 4 local health jurisdictions are now to receive $100,000 to essentially have our epi analysts look at, which they already have been doing here, at the vaping data, particularly around cannabis, and to enhance our surveillance efforts. The information and data that's gathered from these respective analyses are going to be rolled up to help inform a social media and marketing campaign that's going to be launched by the state probably sometime later this year. And to borrow from the pages of the opioid epidemic playbook, there's also plans for a summit, as there have been opioid summits, as I know many of you are aware of, which will be a vaping and cannabis summit. Probably sometime later this year. So so there's a lot in the works as far as our response and the state's response to this. Keep you posted on that. We've had, shifting to influenza, to date we've had, unfortunately, 11 deaths this season. And compared to this time last year, in the last flu season, it's comparable. We had 11 deaths at this point as well. The hospitalizations for influenza cases is a different story. We've had 634 as of Friday, last Friday, 634 hospitalizations compared to 260 hospitalizations this time last year. So more than double the cases that we've seen. We've also seen that the predominant strains that are circulating now are influenza B, Victoria, and the H1N1, influenza H1N1. The influenza B seems to be the predominant strain, and the vaccine's effectiveness is only about 58%, which is not necessarily a good match. It's not a horrible match. When you talk with the folks at the CDC, a 60% or higher match is usually considered a fairly good match. Oftentimes it can be low as 10%, but it's not a good match for that. And children are particularly susceptible to influenza B. So we've seen, let's see, what have we seen here death-wise? We've had 8 deaths in folks 65 plus, 2 deaths in people age 50 to 64, and 1 death of a child. So our advice still stands on this, though. You know, it's still better to get a flu vaccine than not, as it can reduce the duration of the flu and possibly save your life. So we're still pushing for that. As you know, our flu season typically is kind of long here. It extends into May. We really saw our peak in November, although we have seen seasons where we've had double peaks. So we're hoping that won't be the case this year, but it's a bad flu season across the country. And in some ways, Nevada's been spared a little bit lately. So that's encouraging. That's it.
Okay, we appreciate the information. Does anybody have any questions? Dr. Johnson? Okay, hearing none, we will move on to the next agenda item. John Hammond is going to talk to us about EMS transfers and capacity management.
Good afternoon. John Hammond, EMS and Trauma System Manager. In preparing for this little discussion, I was looking at transfer of care numbers from last year to compare to this year, realizing that last year's flu season was not quite as bad as this one is ramping up to be. However, my numbers are really skewed right now because Henderson Fire updated their computer-assisted dispatch system, which caused my surveillance software to break, and it's been broken for about 3 months now, and they're working on it at first watch to try and get those numbers in. However, what I can get is that absent those Henderson Fire calls, we're tracking about the same month over month for transport volumes. It's about 17,000 transports a month to all the area hospitals, and we're tracking this month as well. We're about 7,000 transports in, again, absent Henderson's calls. With regard to that, I understand, I've been speaking with my agencies, that, of course, volumes are up. We all are experiencing the same thing. You guys all have packed hospital EDs. You have logger jams and moving people in and out of your hospitals. And to be honest, the internal disaster numbers that I ran for last month and this month are quite low. They're quite low. December was 40 some odd hours total for 13 hospitals. That's not even 1% of the time that a hospital is open. So far up to yesterday in January, it's been up to 72 hours of internal disaster time. I'll have to look today because the little conversation that was going on back here is there's a lot of wait time in one particular hospital. I just got to look at it and see if it's Chicken Little being Chicken Little, or if it's what's going on, it is actually what's going on in the field. That is about all that I have. Honestly, I'm the purpose of my office is to monitor these numbers only. I can't make any operational decisions on moving people around from one hospital to another. The procedure we have in place for internal disaster and regionalizing the system is working automatically in the background as it has for about a year now, and no one has called me to yell at me yet about being forced open from after being on an internal disaster. Believe me, I know you guys are smoking busy, and so is EMS out there, and it's just going to be another long couple months until flu season is over, and we're going to get some relief come, you know, June, July. Are there any specific questions? Because anything, you guys?
Any questions from anybody? I know it's a very timely subject, obviously, being in flu season. I know that it's certainly a busier season than it was last year. And, you know, a lot of hospitals are reaching capacity, if not at or over capacity. So I thought it's just timely for everyone to have an overall awareness. I know that you have that regionalization information and how you determine when hospitals are in an internal disaster mode or otherwise. I also believe in that document there's some guidance on how to input the fields for your tracking system for the reasons.
Yes, and guidance comes from the state, from Rodney Wright, who actually is an administrator of the EM tracking system. And I could reach out to him if you guys need some more information, if you had some personnel changes. Stuff changes all the time.
It seems to be working okay.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a good idea to send it out again just so everybody has it and it's fresh in everybody's mind.
Pardon me?
I think that would be beneficial.
Maybe just to send it out to the hospitals again, just so it's fresh in everybody's mind?
Okay, I'll reach out to Rodney after this meeting and ask him to resend those to whatever's contact he may have.
I do have, as I'm sitting here thinking about, it's nice to hear the trending continues to go down year over year and the actual hours on capacity is encouraging. But I'm wondering, are you looking at kind of same store numbers? You know, we've got more emergency departments in the valley, a couple more facilities. So it'd be interesting to see if that's having an impact on the numbers as well in a beneficial way. That because I would think from just over the last 2 years, we probably have 4 or 5, maybe 6 more emergency departments, perhaps not attached to a facility, but that may be helping with the issue as well as a
that's certainly benefit. Possible. That's certainly possible. The type of patients we take to those particular hospitals through EMS is a very low subset of patients. Mm-hmm. They have to be sick but not too sick,
right.
Pregnant but not too pregnant. You know, there's a lot of variability there from the EMS side. But I'm sure they're offloading a bit of the sick but kind of well, you know, yeah. Just getting the flu. And it's hard to get those numbers. They're it just takes a little time for you to get the numbers from those particular facilities. They do provide them. It just takes a little bit of time to get them.
I got to believe that is helping in a way. Maybe we don't have, anecdotally, it's got to be helping with some of the lower acuity versus some of the higher acuity patients that, you know, are the stroke and STEMIs and other things. So.
Yeah. The when we were first approached by one of the facilities to allow these areas to receive EMS patients, I was hopeful that an inclusion of some extra beds will offload these kind of times, these kind of flu season-y times, where the lower acuities will be going to there and not clogging up the main acute facilities. So hopefully that is happening. I can't say with certainty yes or no that that's the case.
Yeah. That's always been our position, is all beds online. If we all hands on deck, so if there's availability to help augment, that's great.
Yeah, and they're not in the internal disaster rotation at all because the very, very low number of patients they receive from EMS, so I didn't include them in that.
All right, well, I'm glad the numbers are down, and we appreciate the update. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Any other questions or comments?
I just had one more quick question. So you had mentioned about Henderson Fire not being able to report at this time, and it's been that way for some period. Do you anticipate that may...
Well, Laura, the supervisor in my office, actually called First Watch today to see what the status is on the help desk ticket we put in, and they are manually inputting those calls. And oh my goodness, no. I mean, it's probably 3,000 a month, give or take, that they have to manually input so we can draw that data. I'm actually surprised they're doing it because I don't pay them a lot of money. I pay them very little. And I was like, I think I just burned through my entire year, my year fee that I gave you just on the time to do that. So, but we're going to get that probably, hopefully by the end of the month, because it is a ton of work.
All right. Thank you.
I know that is useful data for us, so we'd like to have it.
Oh, yeah.
We appreciate that. Okay. Community health report, staff report, Dr. Johnson.
Nothing else other than what I already mentioned, although one quick addition related to the flu is you may have seen lately there's a coronavirus, pneumonia virus that's circulating in Wuhan, China, and it's believed to be related to exposure at a South China seafood market. We always keep an eye on these things because folks are just a plane ride away from Las Vegas. And there's been 40 cases to date, one death. They have, the CDC has looked at travel to the U.S. from individuals from Wuhan, China. There's about 58,000 folks a year that come to the U.S., primarily through JFK, LAX, or SFO. And so they're setting up quarantine stations and screening stations at those three airports to determine, to catch people as they come in. So we're kind of always on alert for that. So in case anything happens, we'll certainly let you know. But we keep a close eye on these things. There's been several Hans about that, so you may have seen something that's been in the news. Other than that.
Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Hope it does not become an issue.
Yes.
Let's hope not. Yeah, I mean, the person-to-person transmission is very, very low. They say, although with SARS and MERS and some of the other things we've seen, it did happen. So, yeah.
Okay. Moving on, the next agenda item, Facilities Advisory Board reports. Are there any emerging issues that the board wants to address either now or at future meetings? Okay, if you do, please let us know between now and the next meeting.
Yep.
Okay, very good. Any other public comment? Doesn't look like anyone else is here. So, being none, I guess we will move for adjournment.
Very good.
Okay, thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks.